This is Boston Public Radio. I'm Jared Bowen. We're continuing our arts and culture show with local writer B.A. Shapiro. She's published several books, but the one that made it onto the New York Times bestseller list is her latest work, titled The Art Forger. It's a book about Isabella Gardner, Boston's elite art world, and the compromises an artist will make to make it big. B.A. Shapiro chats with us from WNOG in Fort Myers, Florida. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you.
It's freezing up here, so I hope you're enjoying being in Florida right now.
Yeah, it's sunny and beautiful.
How nice for you. Well, we'll start talking about your book, which is, as we just mentioned, about your essential character here is Claire Roth, who recreates paintings professionally, and she's trying to get past a scandal prior in her career and finds herself in the situation where she has to recreate a Degas, which was one of the paintings in your book anyway that was stolen in that terrible art heist at the Gardner in 1990. And you depict Boston and the art scene here so well. Much of it takes place in the South End, where many people know there are a lot of artist studios, and certainly the SOA open market is held. What drew you to this story and Boston's art world?
Well, I actually live in the South End, so that helped. I spent a lot of time in the galleries down there and in the fabulous museums. And I became very interested in the contemporary art world. But the book really started about 20 years ago when I first encountered Isabella Stewart Gardner. She was a very minor character in my first book, Shattered Echoes. And I knew I wanted to write a book about her someday. And it took about 20 years and the heist and interest in the art scene and learning a lot about art forgery before it all came together into this book.
So what had struck you about Isabella Stewart Gardner? I mean, many people know, of course, you can just see by walking around her museum what an eclectic personality she was, because there wasn't sort of professional curating going on there. She had people assisting her in what she acquired, but the museum is really done to her taste, so things are side by side that, you know, many people wouldn't necessarily put side by side, which is a reflection of her personality, wasn't it?
Well, exactly. That's what attracted me to her. She lived in the late 19th and early 20th centuries, but she was a 21st century woman in the sense that she was going to do things the way she wanted to do them, and she wasn't going to let the constraints of the day control her. And she was very wealthy, lived the life of a Brahmin woman, which was very prescribed, and she just said, not going to do it. I'm going to be who I am. She walked lions down Boylston Street. She went to the symphony with a headband on that said, "Go Red Sox." She became the first great American collector ever, man or woman. And I just love that about her. Maybe I thought that she reminded me a little bit of me. And she's just a fascinating, eccentric, wonderful character.
Well, in the book, you explore, or your character, Claire Roth, explores this possible affair that she might have had with Edgar Degas. And we do know that Isabella Stewart Gardner had a friendship with many of the artists that she collected. What drew you to this relationship, and is there any kernel of truth there?
Well, as I say at the end of the book, I could not, and neither could Claire when she was looking, find anything that indicated that Belle Gardner had ever met Edgar Degas. Although they shared a number of friends, they were in the same circles, she was buying art in Paris when he was in Paris. So he was the perfect person for me to use and create a fictional story that still had a lot of verisimilitude to what actually could have happened.
And I know you are careful to point that out at the end of your book, but I'm wondering if you ever feel responsibility as a writer when you're putting something into the public sphere about, of course, a nonfiction person, a real life person, something that is very fictional that might be tied to them going forward. Do you ever consider that?
Yeah, of course. I don't want to do anything that would, you know, be anything negative against Belle, who is the person I would love to have dinner with if I could have my one person. It's, I think that is taken care of ultimately by the piece at the end of the book, which does spell out what's true and what isn't true. But it's historical fiction, and fiction is the operative word there.
What did you learn about her relationship with men and with people? She also created a great scandal by hanging the painting of her, I believe it's by Sargent, yes, that's in the museum in a very low-cut dress. She's got sort of a halo above her head, which is just not how one depicted themselves in, certainly a woman, how a woman would depict herself, especially in Boston society at that time.
Well, her husband actually, when he first saw that painting, said, it cannot be shown until after I'm dead. And she did not show it until after he had died. And it was a great scandal, but it was comparable to many of the other great scandals that she purposely created and that she loved to create.
Like?
Well, like, for example, the lions. But also, she held soirees in her house where the current literati and artists of the day were. They came to her apartment, and often she was the only woman there among men, which was completely not done. And the men loved her. She wasn't attractive, but her personality sure was. And the men loved her. The women in her society weren't all that fond of her, as you might guess. But she had a mind of her own, and she created this fabulous, absolutely fabulous museum based on her collection.
So let's move forward to, again, Claire Roth, your character here, who's recreating paintings. And this is an interesting industry, and it really does happen. It does exist. I mean, I came across in the research that the Met director had estimated that 40% of art entering the market could be forgeries because this is an industry. I mean, what did you find when you started to dive into this?
Well, this was amazing to me, that the idea that 40% of all of the pieces of artwork put up for in any given year could be actual forgeries was staggering. I had no idea that this was the case.
And so who were, in your book, I mean, this is a woman who's doing it professionally. She's on the up and up. I mean, it's she's doing it for an enterprise. What is it, Above the Couch or something very, very,
yeah, right,
very funny and clever that you've written. But how much demand is there for this?
There's a huge demand for it, both legally and illegally. Claire works for a company called Reproductions.com, and they sell paintings that are acknowledged to be copies of masterworks online. And there are many companies that do this. There are a lot of them in China. And a lot of them mass produce these paintings. And this is completely legitimate because they are sold as copies, and there's nothing wrong with it. Forging, which is what at the beginning of the book she has to decide whether that's something that she wants to do, is completely different because you are not saying it's a copy. You are saying it actually is the painting.
And who are these people, these artists that are doing this? Did you have the opportunity to meet with or speak to any of them?
The people that are doing that, I mean, some are doing it the way Claire is doing it because you can make a living. That's what she did. She spent her days doing these reproductions, and then at night she would work on her own material. So that's one legitimate way to do it. Some people aren't even great artists, so they don't consider themselves to be artists. They're technically good, and they enjoy doing this. So she didn't like it because she felt it was a come down for her. But in many ways, it's a viable profession.
So I'll let you explain in better terms. We'll bring in the Gardner theft, of course, from 1990, which remains it's the most expensive loss of art, stolen solved or unsolved in art history. And so how do you weave in that tale in your book, The Art Forger?
Well, the story of the heist forms the background of the book. And what happened is that, as you said, in 1990, two men dressed as cops walked into the Isabella Stewart Gardner Museum. They tied up the two guards who were there, who weren't really guards. They were more like night watchmen. And they spent 81 minutes going around the museum, and they took 13 pieces of art, Some of them very, very valuable, a Vermeer, a Rembrandt, a Degas. Others not so valuable, like the filial off the top of a Napoleonic flag. And in that 81 minutes, they gathered these up, put them under their arms, walked out of the museum, threw them into their rusted old Datsun, and drove away with $500 million worth of artwork. And as you said, it's 22 years later, and not a single piece of this has been found. So I just found this, as most people in Boston do, fascinating. And I have wondered about the paintings, and I wanted to play around with it.
Well, like, you know, and of course we're reminded all the time, because the museum, keeping with Isabella Stewart Gardner's wishes, does not change anything. Everything pretty much is the way she left it, including the frames from which the paintings were torn from, not just taken, but torn from. So you've dug into this like a lot of people before you, the FBI to a huge extent before you. Many people have written books about this. I mean, have you come away with any sort of sense? I know that you're not collecting the FBI's great reward for this, but do you have a sense of what may have happened? Or because there are so many narratives, but which one do you sort of follow?
Well, the crime makes no sense. It was done very sloppily. As I said, they took some paintings that weren't really worth that much, and they left other pieces that were worth much more. The fact that nothing, one of the major suspects was the Boston Mafia and Whitey Bulger, but it doesn't make any sense that it would have been the Mafia, because they would have tried to sell them and something would have come up by now. So if I had to hazard a guess, one of the groups that they investigated and probably still are investigating is the IRA. And this crime took place in 1990, and they were actively fighting then. And the IRA had a history of stealing paintings, basically kidnapping paintings, and then using them to swap for their imprisoned comrades. So if perhaps they had a few bucks and they hired a couple of, you know, not so clever people to break in, and then they got all of the paintings out of the country right away. And they are being used underground now for, they exchanged the paintings for guns and money and prisoners and drugs, all kinds of different things. So if I had to say, I was forced to guess, I would guess that. But no one knows, and my fear is that that's not the case.
I cover the arts here in Boston, of course, and I frequently run into people in the art world. Yes. And anywhere I go, actually, here or abroad, it's the question I love to ask people, because you just try to get a real sense of what has happened here, because it is so heartbreaking. And I find that the answer is so disparate when I ask people, do you think that the works will ever be returned? And it's across the board, from people who have absolute conviction to people who think at this point they've turned to dust and are probably gone forever. Where do you stand on that?
Oh, I only hope that they will be found, and I wish very much for that to be the case, particularly Vermeer's The Concert, which was always one of my absolute favorites in the museum. But I'm afraid that what happened is actually there were two amateurs that broke in, and they drove away, and they had done it as a lark and realized that they had all of these things and they had nothing to do with them and that they might have destroyed them.
We're talking to B.A. Shapiro, who is the best-selling author of The Art Forger. Does this, now that you've done all of this research, does this make you look at paintings differently whenever you're visiting museums, a gardener and otherwise?
Absolutely. I learned so much. I'm not an artist. I don't have an art history background, but I did a lot of research and I interviewed artists and curators and talked to people about the whole forgery aspect of it. And you don't know. You don't know. As one of the experts said, only the bad forgeries have been found. The good ones are still hanging on museum walls.
Which is just frightening, because you think there's so much technology, and of course museums don't necessarily have the funds to put every painting through X-ray and through the conservation treatments that often reveal whether or not they're forgeries. But is modern technology changing it at all, or are we still probably looking at a number of forgeries on major museum walls?
Well, modern technology is helping, but there are other modern things that are not helping. For example, what is happening now, that this is becoming more well known that these paintings may be forgery, are people are taking the paintings to these authenticators to see if they're real. And so this guy has a $10 million Degas, and then the authenticator tells him, no, it really is a forgery, it's worth nothing. And now these individuals are suing the authenticators because they just lost $10 million.
How is that? I'm not following here. How is that even the responsibility of the?
It isn't, but they're doing it anyway. And now a number of authenticators are refusing to do this, and some of the big collectors, the big authenticators, are just refusing.
Wow. So you've had an interesting story yourself here in that you had written several books and you've been at this for quite a long time. We should also mention that you do teach writing at Northeastern University. And then suddenly it's the Art Forger that has just put you, you know, into the mainstream. You have a publisher. Things are going forward the way you had always dreamed. What changed for you?
Well, everything changed. Basically, I have got my big break after working in the field for 25 years, and it's remarkable. I had published 5 earlier novels, none of which went anywhere, and I wrote this novel, and it was rejected by many, many large publishers, and my agent, Ann Collette, who's also in Boston, said, no, we're going to keep going, when I was questioning it. And she got us to Algonquin Books, who, as far as I'm concerned, is the best publisher any writer could ever want. And they got behind it. They understood it. They put all of their energy into it. And the miracle has occurred.
you've talked a lot about this, that Algonquin has a different method of publishing books from all of the other mainstream publishers, which is what you have found has really helped you here. What do they do differently?
What they do, the large publishers tend to publish maybe 100 books a month, maybe more. Algonquin publishes 25 books a year. The main publishers don't need all of their books to do well. If they have 5-10 books doing really well, that covers them. Algonquin, because they have so few, needs every book to do well. So they promote every book that they have, which is very unusual, and they have an amazingly creative team. And they go at it from a variety of different angles. They put me on the road. They work with all of the independent booksellers. They did advertising, things that don't happen for basically unknown or mid-list writer like me. And it worked.
And that's interesting, because what we hear so much now is people talking about self-publishing and ebooks and going at it their own way, because a lot of people say now that it's the best way, it's the best path to success. Is that largely the case? Were you just the exception here?
No, I think that having a good publisher who gets behind your book is the best path to success. The ebooks and the self-publishing can work really, really well for nonfiction books, because you have a niche and you have a particular message that you're sending out, and you can find the people who are interested in what you have to do. With novels, it's extremely difficult. There are a few people that have made it work, but they are more the exception that proves the rule.
I often wonder this. Is it, at the end of the day, is, you know, like any other industry, music or something where people can put themselves on YouTube and just the right executive happens to click at the right time or the momentum builds? But is writing as much about luck and timing as anything? Because there are so many good people out there who just don't, like yourself, who don't get picked up at the end of the day?
Luck is a huge factor. You need to keep writing, you need to be persistent, you need to be able to put up with rejection, you need to have talent, there's a variety of things. But then that piece of luck comes in. I know many, many writers who write as well as I do and have been working just as long and are being just as persistent, and the luck didn't strike. I got the lightning.
I'm curious about your students. You know, you're frequently asked the question, what do you fundamentally tell your students? But I'm interested what you really glean from your students, how that has helped your career and how that has helped your writing by teaching all of these kids at Northeastern.
It's really interesting. Teaching is a way. I've also taught sociology at Tufts. I'm actually a sociologist. And teaching is a way of organizing your thoughts, really, about a subject that you know a lot about. And by talking about it and listening to their questions and working with their writing and their ideas, it helps me in my ideas and it helps me critique my own work better. And they're just amazing, interesting, fascinating people. I love college students that age. They're not afraid of anything. And they also taught me in some ways not to be afraid.
And finally, you often write what you know. Is Claire you? In what regard is she you? Again, your protagonist in The Art Forger.
Well, it's interesting. When I was writing the book, I was a struggling writer who was not getting recognition and felt very, you know, I was very upset about it. And Claire, at the beginning of the book, is a struggling artist who's not getting recognition, and she's very upset about it. So I kind of poured all of that type of frustration into her. But the really interesting part is that in the book, she does have some success. And when she has the success, she starts developing this imposter syndrome. Like, now that I'm in the mix, am I really as good as I thought I was? And now that I'm having some success, I have the imposter syndrome. And I say, is this really good enough?
I think I've seen a Twilight Zone episode about this. I think you've written your own fake here.
Yeah, it's really funny. Very meta.
I've been talking with Boston-based author B.A. Shapiro about her latest book, The Art Forger. B.A. Shapiro, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
Up next, we talk to someone who has a lot to say about art and the way we perceive it. That's culture critic Camille Paglia. I'll be bringing you that conversation next on Boston Public Radio.